We started last week working our way through the book of Psalms, and if you missed last week, I'd encourage you to listen to the message online just because it sets up the whole year. It's going to be up on our website for the whole year. This morning we're in Psalms chapter 1, and Psalms 1 and 2 together form the doorway into the book of Psalms. Psalms 1 is called a wisdom psalm, so if you read it feels like it should be in Proverbs. And there are a few wisdom psalms in the book of Psalms. And what marks wisdom psalms from others is that they delineate this very clear path between walking with God and walking away from God. It's an either-or approach to life, the wise and the foolish. And our culture commonly believes that truth is a blending of opposites. It's shades of gray, but the wisdom writings in the scripture reveal two distinct paths of living. One is relationship with God, the other is to live life apart from relationship with Him. And Psalms 1 sets out these two clear paths or strategies for living. And if you were to go to the original temple and try to enter into the physical sanctuary back in the days of the temple, then there was the necessity, the requirement that you had intimacy with God, you had a relationship with God. And in the same way, we're going to enter into the literary sanctuary, the Psalms, and there is this presumption of a commitment to know and love God. And so the doorkeeper, Psalms 1, and his friend, Psalms 2, next week, they stand guard on the book and ask everyone who enters here, what do you want? Why are you coming here? If you want something other than God, you're going to read this, but you're not going to be satisfied. Or if you want to come and feel feelings about your feelings, you're probably also not going to be satisfied. And because even though Psalms is about deep emotions, the doorkeeper is a thinking psalm. It's a Proverbs who stands guard at the door to the Psalms. And so he's asking, think before you come to this sanctuary of joys and struggles, what path you want to travel? And I find this fascinating that God has put this book together this way. So let's look at Psalms 1. Rusty read it. But it talks about blessed. And the word can be translated happy, just like in the Beatitudes, blessed can be happy. But not happy as in feelings of lightness every moment or the absence of sorrow, but truly, deeply, permanently happy, blessed. In the presence of sorrow, in the presence of loss and disorientation, there are these loud or sometimes soft echoes saying you're loved, you're safe, because you're ultimately on a good path. So how does this blessed person live and think and feel? First, what they don't do, they don't live the lifestyle of the wicked. And wicked here does not mean a bunch of mini Hitlers or even witches. Wicked here is a description of those who are going their own way, continuing on their own way away from the ways of God. And so if it sounds harsh to call someone wicked, say, well, I know people who don't care about God, but they're essentially good people. I get that. But the truth is in Scripture, everyone is wicked apart from the life-giving grace of God. So by definition, to walk away from God is not merely to act or become wicked, it is to remain that way, to live on that path. And the righteous here are not better, they're not smarter than the wicked. The righteous are righteous because they're walking the path of God. And the lifestyle of the wicked is portrayed holistically with the words walking and standing and sitting. So this is a poetic description of a total lifestyle in opposition to God. So the righteous don't join the wicked in their journey away from God, but what do they do? Well, they delight in the law of the Lord. This doesn't mean we should read this as they love information about God, like an engineer studying plans for a machine or a historian poring over old documents. Delight is what I want out of life. It's the orientation of my heart. And the law of the Lord here simply means the entire revelation of God in Scriptures. It could mean the law of Moses, but here it means the revelation of God in Scripture. And this is the revealed character and nature and will and ways of God. So you can't see this like an author in a book, like Jamin and his book. I like Jamin, I don't like his book. I like Jamin's book, I don't like Jamin. This is the law of the Lord, God revealing himself. This is who I am. So to delight in it means you're delighting in him. And what do you do when you delight in someone? Well, you think about them. You think about them a lot. And what you think about a lot shapes your actual choices. You begin to maneuver your life to get around them as much as you can. Last night, Marie, my niece, and Stephen were married right here. And when Marie and Stephen met each other and decided they wanted to pursue each other, they began to think about their actual calendar, their actual choices. How do I maneuver to get around him, to get around her? So, and on his law, on the revelation of himself, he meditates day and night. So this is not thinking about abstract rules. It's to think deeply about God himself, the God who's revealed there. Over Christmas break, Christy and I were in Denver visiting Casey and John, our daughter, and we went to a little community gym in Denver, and there were these two men that were talking across the room to each other loudly and passionately about the Denver Broncos and the game that night. So loudly and passionately that I found another part of the gym to work out in. And it was clear that they delighted in the Broncos, and they spent a good deal of time meditating on the Broncos. And your life is oriented in the direction of what you want, and we choose this orientation, and then this orientation becomes habitual for us. It becomes reflexive. We choose it, then it begins to choose us. So meditate is not what we commonly think of, maybe like an Eastern religion where it's mindlessness. We sort of empty our mind of thought. This is the opposite of that. This is your mind full of something. You set your mind on very specific things. And so when my gym buddies meditated on the Broncos, they're very specific. As I heard coming out of their mouths, they thought a lot about specific players and coaches and games, even specific plays and possibilities for the future. They filled their minds with thoughts of the Broncos. And this, in turn, shaped the orientation of their lives, what they discussed, how they planned their activities. One guy in the gym was going to go watch the Broncos play that night in Denver, even though it was like 5 degrees outside. So it shaped their choices. And meditating here is also not merely daydreaming, letting your mind sort of wander off into unrealities. If only I played in Mile High Stadium for the Broncos, what would that be like? Terry, wake up. Get back to work. Meditate starts with learning, understanding, and especially for people when the Psalms were being written or formed, it was memorized because they didn't have written versions of it. So the Psalms were originally passed on verbally from person to person, so people had to memorize them. Now, we have them written so we can memorize them and or we can read them. But either way, to meditate doesn't mean abstract thinking, daydreaming, mindlessness. It means to think about the specific words in the context of our everyday lives. So if we were to learn these Psalms and then fail to take them into the world we lived, we would be missing the point. And the Hebrew word used for meditate here is a onomatopoeia, which by itself is a great word, but it's a word that describes sounds like hiss or buzz or bang. And the Hebrew word is a sound that what animals would make, like bark or baa. And it came to mean meditate. It was to murmur, mumbling truth under your breath as you walk through life. And so it's not like a magical spell where you can go around quoting, "You'll keep me in perfect peace, you'll keep me in perfect peace," as if the words themselves have some impact. It's the fact that thinking about the words and what those words point to, some ultimate reality, are what's powerful. And so when I was in a difficult period and I murmured all day long under my breath, and I'm not exaggerating, sometimes all day long, "You will keep me in perfect peace," it wasn't some incantation. I didn't think there was magic in the words. What it was a battle inside my head to orient myself to what's true in spite of what I felt. There was a battle of realities going on. One felt real but wasn't. One felt unreal but was. And so the truth of the scriptures were orienting my mind to what was true. Very important. So meditating day and night on the reality of God is how we choose what or who we delight in. What I delight in, I think about. What I think about a lot, I begin to delight in even more. And what I delight in is what I want and what I begin to want. If I want it more than other things, I orient my life there. This is very simply why we see people sometimes destroy their lives in very surprising ways. If you've ever watched, or maybe you've made a choice, you say, "Why did they give up that for that? How could they do that?" Well, because that they pursued became the delight of their heart. It's what they had learned to love. They oriented their lives to obtain it at the cost of other things that they could have loved. Because at our core, we are all lovers. We orient our lives to what we love. And what we orient our lives to is what we begin to love even more. And so Psalms 1 is clearly this challenge at the doorway of Psalms to love God, to orient our lives to Him. And meditating here is not just loving facts about God, it's about loving God Himself. And the one who loves God is the one who wants to learn to live the path of God. The one who loves God has developed this habit of walking that path. The one who wants to learn God must choose to develop that habit. And you say, well, how can you use habit and love in the same sentence? Because habit and love always go together. What you love, you will habitualize. What you habitualize, you will learn to love. If we love something or someone, we'll orient our lives around them, and it'll become reflexive for us. You say, well, I don't want to become the habit of my loved one. Yes, you do. You certainly do. I don't want to be merely the habit of my loved one, but I certainly want to be one of Christy's habits. I want to be reflexive for her. Let me give you an example. My love for Christy after 30-some years has in many ways become reflexive. She's beneath the surface. She's the background music all the time. So if I'm thinking about other things on the top of my mind, I'm considering her in my choices. How will this affect her? Do I need to call her and let her know about this before I say yes and to check with her? Hey, that song reminds me of her. This has become reflexive. It didn't start that way. First 6 months we were married, I was used to being single, and never crossed my mind to call her and tell her I'd be 3 hours late. You know, who knew? I was playing basketball, and I got home, and I found out, oh, you know, I need to keep her in mind when I make my plans. You say you were ignorant. I certainly was, but now I don't have to put a note on my calendar, remember Chris, remember Christy. She's become reflexive. If you ask her if that feels like more loving or less loving, she would tell you it feels like more loving. And that's what this Psalms is after. It's after the reality of our relationship with God becoming how we reflexively respond to life, all of life. It's really a single story life. Not just God in my morning devotions, not God in my thoughts on Sunday morning, but the reality of God in every aspect of my life. And then what are the results of this path? Well, again, this is a wisdom psalm, so it's compare and contrast. The righteous who walk after God, the wicked who walk the path away from God. And those who walk the path of God are like, this is a poem, it's a simile, they are like a certain kind of tree. A tree planted by flowing water that has seasonal fruit. It's green and growing. And whatever he does, prospers. Now what do you do with that little phrase? Whatever he does, prospers. This is a poem. It's not a promise that if you walk with God, and you can take that, whatever he does, prosper, and apply it to your life and say, well, then I'll become president of Coke someday. I'll become the starting center on my basketball team, even though I'm 4'6". I'll marry him or her. I'll have 4 perfect children. I'll never get a cold. This is a general statement of truth about those who walk the path of God. That's what wisdom literature shows us. And in fact, it is true. So, for instance, Christian couples who do not have active relationships with God, they claim to be Christians, profess Christ, but they don't live in community, they don't do the things that believers do, have the same divorce rate as those who don't claim Christ at all. Christians who do not practice their faith but claim Christ have the same suicide rates as those who don't. However, if you take couples who both claim Christ and are active in living in line with the truth of Scriptures, especially when it comes to community and active involvement there, have much lower divorce rates. The same thing is true for suicide rates. So, the same kind of facts bear out in a variety of other situations, whether it's financial, physical, relational. So, like other wisdom literature, this is a general statement of how life works. And this is how life works. Those who walk in the path of God will live life at its highest levels. They will, in line with God's specific purposes for their lives, they will prosper. I'll give you an example of how that really works out. One of the men who impacted my life tremendously when I first began to decide to walk the path of God was a guy who lived on an island in the West Indies. And I went there over the summer for 10 days. So that's as long as I knew him. He had no education. He never left a small island in his life. His house was about the size of an average American bedroom with 2 children and a wife living there. Their dresser was a box with some clothes in it. And he was a carpenter who didn't own an electric saw. He would build houses during the day, and so he would use his handsaw all day long. His forearm was like Popeye. And he would go home at night, and while his wife would make dinner, he would sharpen his saw for the next day's work. And I watched him for 10 days at work, in his home, at worship. And his life was instrumental in me deciding to walk God's path. What was it that drew me to him? The prosperity of his life. It was the prosperity of his life. So, in every way that mattered, this man prospered. Now the great contrast. Not so the wicked. Those who walk their own path away from God, The righteous are like green growing trees. Those who walk their own paths away from God are like chaff. Now try to imagine a more dramatic contrast. A tree is alive and growing, rooted, fruitful, useful. Chaff is dead, dry, rootless, blown by the wind. It's useless. And that pretty much says it all. Those who walk the path of God, they prosper. Those who walk away are like debris blown by the wind. Now here's a question I have when I read this is, if this is true, and this is a pretty blatantly obvious distinction, if this is true, why do I need to be told it's true? Wouldn't it be obvious? Well, remember, Psalms 1 is a doorkeeper to Psalms, and Psalms is a picture of life itself. And so as you enter the sanctuary of Psalms, you're going to see a lot of things, just like you will in life. So what are some things you're going to see? You're going to see the wicked prosper and the righteous suffer. You're going to see the righteous crying out, like in Psalms 88, darkness is my closest friend. And those not walking the path of God, walking their own way, saying, ha, God doesn't see. Look at me. Look at my life. So the doorkeeper's saying, as you enter here, put on these psalm lenses so you'll be able to know what's real about what you're seeing as you walk around in life. And what's real? Rodney just sang about it. Kim, therefore the wicked will not stand in the judgment, nor sinners in the assembly of the righteous. For the Lord watches over the way of the righteous, but the way of the wicked will perish. So in the final analysis, those who walk their own path away from God will not stand. And in fact, if we could see it like it is, they are already rootless and futureless. And the final judgment of God will reveal that their path was away from life. So meanwhile, it says the Lord watches over the righteous. And watches is the way the New International Version translates this Hebrew word. But the ESV and others translate it better. They translate it knows. And it can be watch. But the word really means having information about someone. And there's a spectrum from just having some basic information about who they are all the way to sexual relationship, knowing intimately. And so in the context, God's not just watching. Look at him walking that path. God is knowing them because this path, like I said, is relationship with God himself. Now I'm going to as we move into our application, I want to give attribution. I was really helped by listening to a lecture by a professor at Calvin College named James K.A. Smith, not our beloved James Smith, but another James Smith. And I really, really helped by his lecture, so I wanted to give attribution. He talked about how cultural experts believe that human beings are primarily thinking things. He called them brains on a stick. And the result of this idea of culture is that we mostly believe that the interactions of people is mostly the realm of messages and ideas. But culture is not primarily an intellectual thing. We're not primarily thinkers. We are thinkers, but we're not primarily thinkers or primarily knowers. We are fundamentally lovers. Everybody is. If you see yourself and others mostly as rational animals, which is how a lot of culture does, you're going to get it wrong. So people don't buy houses and cars mostly because of facts. Now, they may think they do, but that's why they talk about curb appeal or first impressions. We convince ourselves that we're mostly practical, rational people, but that's rarely the main reason we decide. Car ads don't start with someone telling you very slowly the facts. They start with images and sounds and shapes, and they end with high-speed language that no human ear can hear telling you the facts. Because they know people are lovers. And when I read scientists who are committed to a certain view of the cosmos that excludes God, and then some other scientist questions their conclusions, they don't respond often with reason. They respond with emotional responses. Why? Because they've come to love what they've invested themselves in. It's why really, really smart people can do really, really dumb things. Things that don't add up. That doesn't add up. No, it didn't add up. Because it wasn't about math. It was about the orientation of their life. It was about what they loved. When it comes down to it, even thinkers are first and foremost lovers. So Woody Allen, in his corrupt and succinct way, when he had an affair with his adopted daughter, said, well, the heart wants what the heart wants. So if I really want to know who you are, what defines you, I won't ask what you believe or what you know. I'll ask, what do you want? I'll ask, what do you love? If I know what you want, if I know what you love, I know who you are. So St. Augustine, the 5th century North African bishop, In his confessions, he said famously, and this is a paraphrase, "You have made us for yourself, O God, and our hearts are restless until they find rest in you." And he believed that's our basic life operating principle, that we were made to love God. That's our design. And in his confessions, which are 13 books, they're really autobiographical. They start with his as a child and as a teenager coming to Christ, and then they end up with the meaning of Genesis and the Trinity. But all the way through, he's not telling us what he believes. He's telling us there what he loves. And we may not always be able to answer truly if asked, what do I want or what do I love? Maybe we don't even know, or maybe we're afraid to say because we know what we're supposed to love and we know what we actually do love. But the orientation of our lives points to what we actually do want, what we actually do love, because we're all creatures pointed in a direction. We're oriented to the world around us by what we love or desire. I once worked with a man in the military who had an addiction. It had become what he wanted, what he loved. And whatever the current engine driving his addiction, chemical or psychological or both, he got there by his choices, clearly. And eventually, he wanted what he wanted so much that he traded his family, his reputation, his job, and eventually his freedom for it. And you could say his strong desire destroyed him, and you would be wrong, because it was his wrong desire that destroyed him. Desire is never the problem. Wrong desire is the problem. And human beings desire what they see as the good life. What does the good life look like? Even Christians have competing versions of what the good life is. That's what Psalms 1 is about. Competing views of the good life. Go over here and walk and run and hang out and sit with the wicked, or walk over here in the ways of God. And what we believe to be the vision of the good life, we're going to organize our lives to obtain that life. And so Psalms 1 is saying, what if what you want is contrary to the good life? That's a life of destruction. So we're made by God to love God, to long for his kingdom. And the effect of our sin, the effect of brokenness in our lives has not been for us to become non-lovers, but for us to become broken lovers. Let's look in the New Testament, 2 Timothy 3. People will be lovers, look at this, lovers of themselves, lovers of money, boastful, proud, abusive, disobedient to their parents, ungrateful, unholy. And then he says in verse 3, without love, which is really an unfortunate translation because it's not the same word as the other love used here. This word really means heartless. Heartless, unforgiving. They do love, but they love themselves. Unforgiving, slanderous, without self-control, brutal, not lovers of good, treacherous, rash, conceited, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God. And then Jesus said in Matthew 6, no one can serve two masters. Either, here's the either or, here's wisdom literature. Either he'll hate the one and love the other, or he'll be devoted to the one and despise the other. But you can't love God and money. And money here is just representative for any idol you give your heart to. So it's not possible to have two essential core loves. There are clearly two paths, two ultimate life orientations. And so the question is never going to be, do I love? It's always going to be, who or what do I love? And here's how this fits in Psalms 1. Psalms 1, again, is a doorkeeper. He's asking us to consider, what do you love? What do you want? Here's two competing visions of the good life, but only one really is. What do you want? Do you want God? This is the path. Do you want to want God? This is the path. This way of life is a path, not merely a series of ideas or beliefs. So you can't simply just wake up tomorrow and say, today I'm going to love God above all other loves that have been competing for my life's affection. You can say that, but it's not going to happen in your core. It's not going to be accomplished right then, but you can start on that path because it is a path. You can get up and decide, today I'm going to begin to do what I would do if I love God more than I love this and this and this. You do that enough days, and your love is shaped by those choices. We determine our affection, our direction, by choosing our investments. And so this morning, you gather in worship. Some of you, this is a habit. You do it out of habit. You say, well, is that bad? No, that's a great habit. We do most of what we do out of habits. Therefore, we should make sure that we're forming good habits. You experience worship and the Word together. And we're habitualizing what's essential to knowing God. Now, you don't necessarily feel like you've been shaped every Sunday morning by worshiping in community, but over time, you certainly are. And those who stay home are shaped by that choice. We're all being shaped by every choice we make. Reading Psalms daily, whether you feel like it or not, some mornings I read it and I like it, some morning I got to keep reading just to get through it. It doesn't matter. It is shaping me. It's habitualizing the reality of God. And if habitualizing sounds cold and unspiritual and unloving, then think again. Most of what we do day to day is not the result of conscious deliberation. Estimates are around 5 to 7% of what we do in a day as we move through life is conscious deliberation. The vast majority is subconscious, like an iceberg. Small amounts above the water, a lot of it's below the waterline. Driving, brushing your teeth, typing on a computer, breathing. You know, when you first learn to drive, it's all above the waterline. And it's terrifying for you and everybody around you. You've not habitualized driving at all. And so for me, teaching my girls to drive was nerve-wracking for them, which in turn made it nerve-wracking for them. It was nerve-wracking for me, and I made it more nerve-wracking for them. But as you become a better driver over years, what happens? Have you driven home in the last month and didn't even know you drove home? You just were in your driveway? You habitualized it. Basketball players, when they first learn to play basketball, you can tell they're learning because nothing is habit. Everything is above the waterline. And if you want to be a good basketball player, it has to become reflexive because things happen so fast you don't have time to consciously think of them. They become reflexive. Christy's been teaching kids to play the piano for 30 years, and I've watched a lot of kids go from painfully looking for each note to playing great pieces beautifully. Christy can play pieces and cook dinner in her mind at the same time. Now, what if love for God, walking His path, became reflexive for us? What if the orientation of our lives became automatically towards God? Now, don't misunderstand me. I'm not talking about getting to the place where we go through the motion. Not what I'm saying. That would be making faking love for God reflexive. I'm talking about that you're building habits. You're a spirit who inhabits a body, your soul and body. This is a one-story life. And you don't live in neutral space ever. Everything you do, everywhere you go, is calling out for your affection. You are habitualizing something. We always are. And so the reason we're spending a year in Psalms, why I read it every day, is because I know I'm responsible to decide who I'm going to love. And we live in a culture that believes you can't choose who or what you love. It just happens to you. Like I told Stephen and Marie last night, there's no magic wind that blew you two together. They met. They decided to meet again. And then they made a whole bunch of investments over a period of time. If at any point in time along the way they had stopped making investments, it would have been game over. No magic wind would have blown them all the way to the altar. So if you fall in love with someone other than the one you're supposed to be loving, your spouse, magic wind didn't blow you into their arms. You made a series of choices that made it happen, and we're responsible. We're culpable for who we love. If you find yourself loving the wrong person or the wrong things, then you're responsible to stop investing in those things. If you don't love your children or your friends as much as you love yourself or your hobbies, it's because you're making investments in yourself and your hobbies that trump your investments in others. That's just the facts. We're all the time automating responses, choosing our loves. What we're doing, reading, watching, thinking, listening to is orienting us to a certain vision of the good life. And our practices are not merely things we do, they are things that are doing to us. There's no neutral space. Everywhere you go, go in your car, go on the web, go to the mall, go to the mountains, all that has the potential to develop a vision of the good life, to draw your heart to love, to want something. Now, I'm not saying you should run from malls or computers unless you should. But we have to understand we all practice what we love, and what we practice will become what we love. And everywhere you go, there's competition for your affection. If you go to bed and close your eyes and say, okay, the competition for my affection is closed today, is it? No. It's right there inside your own brain. And that's why the doorkeeper to Psalms is telling you, do you want to live the God-blessed life? Then habitualize walking God's path. Make it reflexive or move that direction. So it's asking, what do you want? Because what's next is going to be 149 Psalms saying the same thing over and over from different directions. Why? Why the repetition? I said one of the keys of Psalms is parallelism, which says the same thing and says the same thing again from a different angle. Why is it doing that? It's trying to get into our heads. So it can get into our lives. Do you want to love God? Do you want to live a life where you experience Him more fully? Then scrutinize what you're already habitualizing by your choices. And if you want to grow in faith and love this year, it's not like you're just flipping a coin. I hope so, but it's not really within my choice. It is within your choice. There's two people can stop you from loving God more this year. Two persons. God can stop it. You can stop it. God won't. Who's that leave? He says simplistic. It's not simplistic. God is all for it. We have to decide to be all for it. Sure, cry out to God for help. This is not just mere human activity. Cry out to God for help. Enlist help from other people. That makes good sense. If you mess up, fess up and move on. But the world around you is charged with competition for your affection. Chaff has no habitual location. Its only habit is to be blown by random winds. A tree has habitualized its location. In Psalms 1, it's picked up a great location by streams of water. So let me give you one thought on blessing. As you move into this year and you think about, I'd like to live the blessed life. I'd like to live the God-blessed life. The blessed tree prospers in all it does. So what are the implications? How should we be careful to pay attention to where our mind goes with us as we think about a blessed life? This week I was with my friend Muhammad, and he said, Terry, does a tree ever eat its own fruit? And I said, no. A tree produces fruit, and who eats the fruit? Others eat that fruit. And so as you meditate on what blessing and prosperity mean, keep that in mind. The picture, the simile here, is like a tree that produces fruit. The blessed tree is producing fruit to bless other people. So as you move through life saying, I want to live the God-blessed life so I'll be blessed, it's probably going to take our mind on a wrong course. It's not the blessed path that Christ walked. His joy was in giving His life away. The blessed tree, the prosperous tree, yields fruit for others to be blessed by. And the great truth of living in community is Ron produces fruit, I get to eat, and I produce fruit, he gets to eat. We get to mutually bless each other. That's why the great commandment Jesus said was to love God with all your heart and soul and mind and love others as you love yourself. So here's something I encourage you to think about internalizing this year as you think about all this. And then just see what happens in and around you. Selfishness is a universally failed method for happiness. It's never worked in the history of man. Sacrifice is a Christ-proven method for happiness. That's the blessed life. Let's pray together. Talk to God and contemplate, meditate on what He's saying to you this morning.